go. Here we go. Some of you probably were here yesterday, and some of you probably were not. Glad that you made it today. We're talking about how to rescue people, and rescuing people takes a great deal of effort. Now, it's something that lay people can do. After I went through some of the explanations yesterday, a couple of people approached me afterwards and said, that sounds pretty complicated. Can we do it? Well, yes, it's designed for people to do who are not professionals. Okay? Now, again, I'm going to be showing you a whole lot of stuff on the PowerPoints today. Don't feel left behind that you won't have time to write it all down, because you will not. We will make available to you for free an e-book that has all of this information in it plus more, and you can have it with no charge whatsoever. We intend to put the two audios from yesterday and today with the e-book on our website. Now, Marriage Helper, that's the name of the organization. If you look at that as one word, Marriage Helper, marriageheler.com, if you go to marriagehelper.com, if you decide to become a member, and right now membership is free, if you decide to become a member, then you can have access to that and many other materials as well. As a matter of fact, while it's free, go ahead and tell everybody that you know, in your church and every place else, go ahead and join now. And there's all kinds of e-books and articles and podcasts and videos and a forum, all of that stuff you have access to for free. Now, this particular e-book is not up yet, because of the fact we're waiting for me to finish these two audios, and then we'll put them up. And so you'll have the audios, and you'll have the e-book if you wish, and you can use this to actually help people who are in trouble, if you will be so kind as to do so. Now, I'm not going to go back through all the stuff that I talked about yesterday. If you missed it, get the audio or go look at the e-book, and it'll tell you things. But basically, you talked about how people get addicted to certain behaviors. Oh, by the way, quick commercial here. Because of a recent rearranging of my Sunday schedule, if anybody's interested, I am now starting to go out on the road again on Sundays and speak for churches. So if you'd like to have somebody come and split your church, speak for your church. It's a joke. I'd be happy to come do that. Now, people invite me to talk about spiritual warfare because people still like that book that I wrote, or sometimes talk about how to deal with pain and agony. We deal with that a lot. Or Rubel ended up his class talking about the new heaven and new earth. Also have a book about that. Glad to talk about that. Or, if you wish, we can do a one-day marriage seminar just on Sunday at your church, fitting within your regular Sunday morning schedule and one afternoon schedule. And we talk about intimacy and those kinds of things. And in the afternoon, we do a thing on personalities. That's just hilariously funny. But at the same time, very, very practical. And if you want to have us come do that at your church, also, since we changed over to a nonprofit last year, we're not charging an arm and a leg for this anymore. We try to come within your church's budget, if you got $50,000 or $60,000. No, we really try to come within your church's budget to do that. So that's available. You can also contact us through marriagehelper.com if you're interested in any of that. Now, if we can put that first slide up here, just to remind you, well, one more if you don't mind, to remind you a little bit about what we talked about yesterday before we get to what we're saying today. Why is it important to understand that people caught up in sin are living in a state of delusion? Because if you accept the fact that if they're living in a state of delusion, then you will view them differently, and then you will come at them and approach them differently. So our next slide says, you will stop expecting self-deluded people to come to their senses. People have been doing that all along. Well, sooner or later, he'll come to his senses. Or he's lying when we talk to him. He's not receptive at all. We can't help him. Do not expect self-deluded people to be reasonable. The next slide says, then this, throw out that old, terribly wrong concept that there is nothing anyone can do until a person wants help. That's just false. It's just not true. As a matter of fact, it's the people who don't want help that we need to be helping. And the reason they don't want help is because they're self-deluded. They've convinced themselves that what they're doing is okay. Therefore, they don't look for help. They're not asking for help. And then on the next slide, just wrapping up from yesterday, people addicted to damaging behaviors do not want help because they cannot allow themselves to admit that what they're doing is wrong. Their delusions make them believe that everything they do is okay and everything that they say is the truth. The next slide, please. That means they cannot help themselves. They will not overcome their damaging actions without help from someone who cares and who's not deluded about their behavior. And the next one, we'll wrap up. That's why it is crucial that people who care intervene. The spouse, for example, we talk about this most in the context of marriage, the spouse cannot do it alone. It is amazing how often they're left to do it by themselves. even by the people who go to church with them, who say, well, we'd love to help, but we don't know what to do. Or sometimes even say, well, we shouldn't put our nose in other people's business. Give you a quick Bible example. When Jesus, you read the story in the book of Luke, is going along and there's a woman who's burying her only son and she is a widow. Nobody would put their nose in her business, but what does he do? He actually walked up and touched the coffin, or whatever they had in place of a coffin, which made him ceremonially unclean instantly. He put himself into a situation where nobody would do it because of the fact that he saw her hurting and he was there to help. If we're going to follow the example of Jesus, that's what we do. And so now, the next one, please. If you're going to help the person, then you need to understand the delusion, and that's what all of yesterday was about. That means you will not allow yourself to be sidetracked. I'll guarantee you, when you try to help somebody who is in some addictive behavior, whether it's alcoholism or whether it's having an intense illicit affair, they're all still addictions, trust me, they will do everything they can to sidetrack you. If you understand the delusion, you will not allow yourself to be sidetracked. You will not be goaded into an argument or debate, because if they can get you into that, then they will not deal with their sin. They're going to take you off in another direction. You won't believe when they tell you things like, in a marriage, I never loved her. You'll hear it. You'll say, I understand what you're saying, but you don't believe it because of the fact that it's really not true. It's what they believe to be true right now, but it's not. You'll not accept their interpretations. They'll tell you all kinds of things, but they're altering history. They're not consciously altering history. In other words, they didn't sit down and say, what lie will I tell? They honestly, genuinely believe it the way they're telling it to you, but it's not accurate. And then you'll understand that you need to bring their repression to light. They're pushing this stuff down. And if you can momentarily interrupt their actions, you can actually guide them on a healing path. Now, that summarizes all of yesterday, so let's move into today. Okay, what is intervention? The next slide explains it. It says, intervention does not stop the bad behavior. Intervention is not designed to stop them. It leads the person to a point of admitting his or her self-delusion. So properly done intervention breaks through the rationalization, leading to a period of lucidity where the person is willing to find help. So don't think that an intervention is going to fix it. An intervention gets them to start doing the things to fix it. Are we all together on that so far? Okay, the next one then is, presenting reality means presenting facts about the person's behavior and the consequences that have happened already or that will happen because of that behavior. The intervention must therefore be objective, unequivocal, and caring. I'm going to go to the next slide and see if I can start making this make some sense. While intervention is confrontational by nature, it is not punishment. Your job is to use the methods available to you to break through the person's self-delusion so that he can see clearly what's happening. So you're not going to call them names. You're not going to tell them that they're going straight to hell if they don't straighten up. Now, maybe they are, and maybe that's your approach, and if you so choose, you can do that. But intervention is designed to get the person to actually see that what he or she is doing is wrong. And in that moment of lucidity, when they finally can see, because now they're not seeing just their rationalization, they're seeing what is actually existing, then at that moment you can potentially help them. And so the next slide says, it must take place to stop it. Then immediately, you've got to tell them what to do next. All right, now, you'd be better off to leave them alone in the first place than to intervene and then leave them alone. Yesterday, I mentioned the fact that my wife and I have been married to each other twice. By the way, many people have asked, you know, is your wife here? To which I replied, my first wife or my second wife? She doesn't think that's funny at all. Alice, would you stand up just for a second so they can see? This is my wife, Alice. This is the woman who forgave and took me back after I had gone crazy for a period of time and that I love very dearly. Now, while we were apart, I wound up living in Birmingham, Alabama. I had no job. I had no food. I kept looking for work. But my pride made me think that I was worthy of doing things that would make you a lot of money. Interestingly, my background had only been as a preacher. This may surprise you, but corporations aren't lining up saying, find us ex-preachers. They're just not doing that. Now, I could have flipped hamburgers or something, but I was way too proud for that. And if I got my hands on $10, I put it in the gas tank so I could keep looking for work. And so I'd go sometimes 3 or 4 days without food at all. In the midst of that, I ran into a minister in the Churches of Christ. I'll leave him unnamed. And he somehow had found me. I don't know exactly how he did. I can't remember. It's been a long time ago. But he said, you're in pretty bad shape, aren't you? And I said, yes. He said, well, never fear. Your brother is here. I'm going to take care of you. It's going to be okay. I felt like what I think a person must feel like if they fall off the ship and they're in the ocean and they know there's no way they can possibly swim to safety, that they're going to drown, and then somebody throws them a life preserver. That's how it felt like. Maybe somebody actually cares. That was in 1985. I have never seen or heard from him since that day. Never. So you see, if you're going to tell somebody, I'm here to help, I think you ought to help. Because it's really a pretty scary and finally disillusioning thing to hang on to the life preserver and realize there's no rope on it. That they just threw it to you and sailed away and left you alone. If you're going to help people, help them. But you must understand that it's not always going to be easy, and some days they'll bite you. Because of the fact that they, well, anybody ever dealt with a hurt animal? Like, we have a cat named Al Cat. I don't know why we named him Al Cat, but we did. Al Cat's a working cat. We live on 5 acres. Al Cat lives outside, and he kills the mice and the snakes and the neighbor's pets. So Al Cat, because of where we live, there's also coyotes. And one day, our daughter Joanna and her husband Lee came home, and there was Al Cat under a bush, and he was pretty torn up. Apparently, the coyotes had gotten to him. And they knew that cat's hurt, that cat needs help. But because he's hurt, if we try to pick him up, this cat has switchblades. Outside cats have switchblades, and they thought, trying to help him can get us hurt. That's what it's like helping a person who is in a mess. Sometimes they're going to hurt you. Oh, by the way, they wrapped him up in a towel so he couldn't cut them. They took him to the vet. They called Alice and said, the vet says it's going to be at least $500, and then there's no guarantee. So Alice, with tears, said, put him to sleep. And so they did. Joanna cried. Alice cried. Lee and Joanna came home, and on the front porch was Al Cat. We have no idea whose cat we killed. That is absolutely true. Every bit of that story is absolutely true. All right, look at the next slide then. Here we go. How do you do it? Next slide. Here's how you do it. The process is simple. The methodology requires a few hours of preparation and calls for very specific actions, and here's where it falls apart. I have helped people before saying, okay, this is how you do it. They look at it and they go, it's going to take us a while to prepare for that. Yes, it will. Not weeks. You can do it in hours. You can do it in hours, but because it does require preparation and it does require rehearsing some things, some people go, we'll just do it by ear. Then they do it, and it doesn't work. What we're going to share with you here, it did not come from me. It came from many other people who've done it for many years. I've just put it together to show you what actually works. If you do it, I beg of you to follow exactly how they say to do it. Okay? All right, the next slide. Intervention requires 6 steps. Here's the first one. Gather the team. But look at the next slide, and what that says then is this. You make a list of people that surround the person. Maybe the person's employer, co-workers, parents, mate, children, close friends, co-workers, spiritual leaders, and the like. Pray over the list, seeking to find the right people, and then recruit a group of 3 to 5 strong group members. Okay? You don't want more than that that actually go. Look at the next slide. Each should have some kind of a relationship with the person. The more important the relationship, the more effective the person will be on the team. Now, my dear, dear friend Buddy Bell sitting right here. I love him as much as any man in the world. If Buddy were on a team intervening with me, he'd have tremendous power because of the great love and respect I have for him. Whereas if you found a guy from 1985 who promised to take care of me and brought him and he tried to intervene, I wouldn't listen to a word he said. It's like, I don't think you care about me. So you try to find people that have some kind of relationship, and the more important the relationship, the more effective they're going to be. So look at the next slide. Each team member must be willing, catch this, must be willing to risk the relationship. Interventions don't always turn out the way you wish them to. Sometimes they'll actually pull away from you and have nothing to do with you whatsoever at all. You say, well, why would we do it then? I think that you have to evaluate what a person's soul is worth in relationship to what your relationship with them is worth. If the chance to save them is more important to you than whether they like you or not, then you would do the intervention. If it's more important to you that they think well of you than you trying to save them from what they're doing to themselves, then don't do it. So you find people then that have some backbone. The next slide says this. The team should have no person who will cower emotionally if the person initially reacts negatively to the intervention. Because sometimes in the intervention, they get mad. They can say some nasty things. They can use some words that you don't typically hear at church. Okay? Not typically hear at church. Neither should the team have a member who will become angry and start attacking, verbally or otherwise. I mentioned yesterday Jimmy Allen. Jimmy Allen's my hero. I dedicated one of my books to Jimmy Allen. He tried to intervene after I left Alice. But Jimmy's got a temper. And this is not to put Jimmy down. He's a great man of God. You understand? But he didn't understand how to do this. And when I balked, he got mad and his anger came at me. What do you think they did for me? It justified my saying, you don't have a clue what you're talking about. You don't know me. You don't understand what I'm going through. Why should I listen to you? And his anger gave me the excuse to ignore him. Now, he's not a bad guy. He did try to help. But you understand he didn't understand this. You can't do that. Okay, look at the next one. Each team member, and these are two things here, should have specific knowledge of unacceptable behavior on the part of the person or specific knowledge of negative consequence the person will face if she continues her damaging behaviors. Either one of those. Let me illustrate. Do you think it's possible that sometimes people might want to intervene because they think somebody's doing something they really aren't doing? Yeah. That happened to me once. Now, I've done a lot of rotten stuff in my life, okay? Not proud of it, but at the same time, I don't try to pretend I've always been the goody-two-shoes guy. Several years ago, I had a female college student, come to my office to confront me about my affair with her roommate, which was not occurring. I was totally innocent. I don't mean to be crude, but if I were going to have an affair, it wouldn't have been with her. So, she came in and said, I know that you're having an affair. And I said, what? She said, I've been reading her diary. She doesn't know it. And this girl in her diary had been writing fantasies about me. This woman had read it and assumed they were all true. And she said, I read about when you did this and I read about when you did that. And I'm saying, before God, none of this is true. She said, I know it's true. And I said, then this is what you do. You go see our elders. You take the diary to them and you have them confront me about my sin so they can call her in. And then we'll deal with this. This is one of those things I have not done, I am not guilty of. I've done a lot of stuff, but I haven't done that, okay? You want to make sure that they have specific knowledge. Because if you come in with just some generalities, they're going to blow you away. So either I know what you've done, or I'm going to tell you about a specific negative consequence that's going to occur if you continue to do this. Are you with me? For example, I was over in Searcy a few years ago, and speaking to a minister's luncheon about what we do in saving marriages, there was a woman there, a young woman, who gave her testimony about what we do in our ministry. She said, my parents, now this is not to attack church people in any shape, fashion, or form, just to tell the story. She said, my father was an elder in our church, and everybody thought my father and mother had the best marriage there was. But at home, we knew it was not that at all. As a matter of fact, they never spoke directly to each other. If we were sitting at the dinner table and my dad wanted the mashed potatoes, he would say, tell your mother to pass me the mashed potatoes. Mother would reply, tell him, he can reach it himself. She said they never spoke directly to each other, and we knew that when our younger brother graduated from high school, that marriage was over. They were just waiting for him to graduate, and then the whole church was going to be shocked by this. So she said, I and my other sister were both married already and had children. We came and told our parents, you will go to Joe's three-day workshop for marriages in trouble. It doesn't have to work, but you have to go. And if you don't, here are the consequences. You will never see your grandchildren on a major holiday. You can see them otherwise, but not Thanksgiving, not Christmas. But if you go spend 3 days at that workshop, whether it works or not, then you can see your grandchildren on major holidays. In other words, here's a consequence. Now, never, ever give a consequence that you're not going to hold them to. Don't lie. If you're not going to do it, don't say you're going to do it. By the way, they came to the workshop. It worked. She said, now it's really weird at a holiday at our home. I said, what do you mean? Like my father will look at my mother and say, honey, would you pass the mashed potatoes? And she says, yes, dear. And we're going, something's very wrong. This is not how this is supposed to happen here. So look at the next slide then. Second step, gather the data. The information with which to confront must be specific incidents or specific consequences. They must be facts that will cause the person to admit that what they're doing is wrong, even if they're momentarily admitted. So the next slide says, as long as they can offer plausible explanations or attack others, they will not face their own behaviors. A young lady told me several years ago that one of the ministers of her church, and I'm really not trying to pick on ministers, I just, you understand, we deal with a lot of people. She said, we had heard the rumors that he was involved with a woman in our church. Nobody had the proof, but she lived in the same apartment complex that I lived in, she said. One night, I saw him pull into a parking place at our apartment complex, and I watched him go to her apartment. She said, the next morning, when I was leaving for work, I saw him come back and get into his car. So I went to his office the next afternoon and confronted him. I know you spent the night with her. Now, that's specific behavior, right? But if they can give you any plausible explanation, they will. They'll do anything they can to make you doubt it. He said, yes, I was there. And yes, I was there all night. But you understand that everybody in this church has turned against me, and the only friend I have is her. And so we sat at her table all night long talking and praying and reading Scripture together because she's the only strength I have. Then he said, the fact that you think I was doing something wrong probably says more about your heart than mine. He kept on with that and kept on with that. He was so smooth that finally, she said, by the time I left Joe, I thought, I'm an evil person. But you understand, addicts are really good at what they do. If we can head you in a different direction, we will. Now, understand, I'm an addict. I'm a recovering addict, but I'm an addict. All right? We will head you in a different direction. We are the best liars on the planet.
Yep.
I hate it when the audience is funnier than I am. But they did make me think of something. By the way, if you want to get on an email list where I can email you how to find this stuff, just put your name. You guys will pass that around different directions while we're talking. So what you want to do is not allow yourself to be sidetracked because they'll do that. The intervention team overpowers the delusions by offering fact after fact. If they come at you, you don't argue, you don't debate, you listen. Oh, okay, so you prayed all night. But the fact is you spent all night in the home of a woman you're not married to and you're married to somebody else. That is wrong. And then you don't debate. You keep going. Okay, look at the next thing. To do an intervention properly, every fact, circumstantial or otherwise, must be written on paper before you go do it. Now, here's where people will go, well, no, we can do this. When you get in there and the fur starts flying, it's easy to get sidetracked. It's easy to get distracted. It's easy to forget what you were going to do. So you write it all down. Okay? Now, you have a team, 3 to 5 people. Each of you are writing down things. These are things that are, this is what you did, or things about these are the consequences you're going to have. Okay? You with me so far? Now, they can also take statements from other people who are not going to be on the team. But those people have to sign the statements. All right, look at the next slide here. There are two categories that you write. The first has to do with evidence of the wrongful behavior. Each member of the team must write what he or she will say. You see, you actually are going to read it to the person. You're really going to read it. You say, why do you do that? Because what happens is when you go to the next slide. I'll show you this. Everything must be in unsparing detail. I saw you kiss her instead of, well, I thought you were being a little too familiar. It's got to be direct. And sometimes it's hard for church people to do. But it's got to be direct. The person will dismiss anything you give as a generalization. Therefore, you've got to talk about specific things. Okay? Next slide. The second category has to do with consequence. Each person should write specifically what the consequences already have been or what they will be if the person continues in this behavior. Now, It could be a spouse saying, if you come home drunk one more time, you're out for 2 weeks. If you come home after that drunk, you're out for a month. The third time you come home drunk, you're not coming home at all. Now, that sounds harsh, doesn't it? But the people who deal with addicts will tell you right now, if you make those kinds of contracts with them and you don't fulfill it to the letter, if you offer grace or mercy, they're going to manipulate you till the cows come home. Again, you ready, brother? We're great manipulators.
Right,
yeah. There you go. All right. We're good liars and we're good manipulators. So you have to do that. Okay, look at the next thing then. No one should say anything that she doesn't feel. Or in other words, you've got to mean it and you've got to stay behind it. The next slide. Do not make vindictive or angry statements. If you come across as punishing or self-righteous or condemning, the other person is going to resort to their defensiveness. I'll give you an example. Another friend of mine who has gone to be with Jesus was the man who fired me when I was caught in my sin in Montgomery, Alabama years ago, the sin that caused me to go ahead and divorce Alice and go off and live like a heathen for 3 years. I was captured. Okay? I was caught. There's nothing more humiliating, by the way, than sinning and then getting caught in your sin. And then everybody knows. You understand? Now, the man who fired me was a really good man. As a matter of fact, was my friend till the day he died, and is my friend now. I just don't get to talk to him like I did before. But the way he fired me gave me a way to continue to justify what I was doing. Because it came across, and he didn't mean for it to, but it came across as self-righteous and condemning. Actually, here's what he said, and you can understand his logic. I have no argument against his logic at all. He said, I have a church on one hand and you on the other. Which one do you think I'm going to sacrifice? Now, I understand his thinking. It's brilliant. But what do you think I heard? You don't care about me. I'm the sacrifice. Okay, big hairy deal. All you church people are hypocrites anyway. And that allowed me to continue to justify my behavior for a longer period of time. It's not his fault. It's mine. But you understand how that played into my defensiveness. Okay, the next slide. You pick one of those people to be the leader. Okay, somehow or other you pick a leader. The leader makes a clear charge of the wrongful behavior and a clear call to action. Now that means he too has to write down what he will say. By the way, when you do that, you're going to have a rehearsal. Let me go to that in just a minute. Go ahead to the next slide, please. I'll talk about that in a minute. Next slide, please. Third step, rehearse the intervention. Have at least one meeting where the team brings together their written statements. Designate the chairperson, of course. His job is to prevent the intervention from getting off track. So what you do when you get together is this. Each person reads what they're going to say. The whole group then says, okay, that's good, but I think maybe we change that, or maybe we add that, maybe we delete that. You do it as a group. Then, and I'm going to skip a couple of slides here to make get through on time, then what you'll do after you've all done that is that you're going to do it again, but now you're going to designate somebody to be the person that you're intervening with, okay? So we'll turn to one member of the group, so like Buddy, and say, okay, Buddy, you be the guy. Then I'll read my statement, and Buddy's job is to come up with anything he can to come back at me with that he thinks that guy might do. Like, it might be an argument, it might be an attack on me, it might be a rationalization, it might be a justification, and you all take turns doing that. Why do you think that would be of value? I'm sorry, I thought I asked you all a question. Okay? Be prepared, because if you think in advance what he might say or she might say, then nothing's going to catch you off guard, or it's unlikely anything's going to catch you off guard. And whatever they say, you're ready because you've already together thought out, if he says that, here's how we're going to answer that. Now, I actually coached a team a couple of years ago to this very thing. They were going to go see a guy, and I did not have the connection to him they did. So they met me at Chili's. And it was going to be a late-night intervention. They actually were going to his house after we met, and we met like at 9. And we sat there, and I rehearsed them through these things again and again and again, and I played the bad guy because I know how. And they would say, I'm going to do this, and I'd go, boom, boom, boom. And then they have to stop and think. And then they do that, and I'd say, then I'd say this, boom, 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 so that when finally they left there, they were prepared. They weren't afraid anymore. Because there's a natural anticipation that this is not going to work right, that we're going to blow it, that somehow I'm going to do the wrong thing. This is going to work, you know, the person is going to be worse off than he was before. And so the rehearsal helps you work all those things out. You may not think of everything, but you'll think of most everything. And then when you go, you're confident. But by the way, you also choose who will answer what objection. If he does this, Charlie, you say that. If he does that, then Mary, you do that. Now, that's why most people never do the interventions. It's like, well, can't we just all go and work it out when we get there? You can. But it may turn out really, really bad, because if he starts attacking you, your natural inclination is going to be to defend yourselves. Or if he says something, your natural inclination is going to be to argue, and none of that's going to work. None of it. Because once they start attacking you and you defend, or they start arguing and you argue back, you're off task. They can lead you on a merry, merry chase. Has anybody ever had that happen when you tried to help somebody? You're off on this merry, merry chase. I did it. When Alice and I were divorced, I was living in Birmingham. A guy from Montgomery, who was a really good guy, found me. And he came in and was doing his best to try to do an intervention on me by himself. He's a really good guy, and I really appreciate his heart, but he had no idea what he was doing. So how did I handle it? I cussed him like a dog. He got his feelings hurt. He almost cried. And he walked out the door and left. Now, that doesn't say anything bad about him. He's a good man who tried to do it. You follow? But most people don't know how to handle it when the addict comes back at them like that. Now, I'm ashamed of it. Interestingly, he doesn't remember that. A couple of years ago, I said, remember the time you came to see me? He said, yes. And I said, remember how badly I cussed you? And he said, I don't remember that at all. Oh, I do. I said, no, I didn't. I did not do that. All right, let's look at the next slide. During the rehearsal, each member reads. I've already told you all about that. Okay, the next one, the chair decides what order. So who goes first, who goes second? Look at the next slide. Rehearse everything. Next one, I'm just trying to get through in time up here. With each reaction from the wrongdoer, the group discusses and decides what's the best response and who should make it. Next slide. Fourth, finalize the details. Have one educational meeting. Let me explain what that means. Get the e-book. In your educational meeting, if you want to, you can listen to the audios as well, because the Alcat story is great. But at least get the e-book. And you sit down in your general meeting or educational meeting and just make sure you understand delusions and understand the process. That's all you do in your first meeting. Just make sure everybody gets it. If somebody in your team doesn't get it, you probably should excuse that person from your team. Now, the second meeting is when you come back with your written statements, either from you, and again, you can get them from other people that they signed them, okay? And you want facts, you want evidence. And let me give one caveat here. Sometimes people ask me, because we deal with marriages in crisis, that's what we do, okay? If ever you've got a couple in crisis, send them to us. Our success rate since 1999 is 77%. It's not 100%. But 77% is pretty doggone good, I think. Amen. Obviously, it shows that God showed up. Because one of my psychiatrist friends said, I know this is from God, Joe, because you're just not that smart. I concur. By the way, if you ever come to one of our three-day workshops, and sometimes people come as observer couples, if you ever come, you will actually see what I refer to as miracles. I understand in our fellowship we would call it something else. But I'd call it miracles. You'll see amazing and amazing things happen when people turn around. Now, knowing that that can occur, people ask us questions sometimes like, I'll give you an example. A guy told me, he said, I'm pretty sure my wife is cheating on me, and I'm pretty sure I know who it is, and so I just hit a GPS thing in her car, and then wherever she goes, I know where she is, and when she's with him, I'm going to go catch him. He said, what do you think of that? I said, I think you need to go ahead and get the divorce attorney. He said, why? And I said, because you're going to divorce. He said, what do you mean? When you do something sneaky like that, and she realizes you caught her by doing that, she's not going to deal with her adultery. She's going to deal with her offense that you did something like that. And so you won't deal with the real issue, which is her being involved with this guy, because all she's going to lock into is, how dare you violate my privacy? He said, no, she'll straighten up. Okay. Let's see. We see it all the time. You say, wait a minute, but don't I have a right? Sure you do. Here's what I typically advise people. This is my opinion. You can take it or leave it. If you want to do that, do it, but be ready for the marriage to end. Because if you catch the person that way, the likelihood of divorce occurring rises dramatically. Because, again, they're not going to focus on what they've done. They're going to focus on what you do. Do you follow? On the other hand, sometimes people stumble across this stuff. Like I picked up a cell phone to look at something the other day, and there was a text message, and you should have seen what it said. Sometimes it's the teenage kids that catch them. Teenagers are pretty sharp. I never used to be so dumb. And in their process of being so sharp, they often figure out what their parents are doing before their other spouse do. And they'll look. And passwords, they can figure out how to get past those things. You know, they understand all the electronics, et cetera. And so we hear a lot of them where it's the teenager or preteen that caught the one who was doing something wrong. Now, they typically won't have the same reaction toward the child as they would toward the spouse. You follow? You say, so if my teenager found this and confronted my spouse, can we use that in the intervention? Absolutely. Anything that's already known can be used in the intervention. So let's suppose it's the elders of the church that decide to go. Three or four of them to get together, or five, they become the team, and they go and do that. Can they say, we have here the text that your kid found on your phone? Absolutely. They can use any facts that they have. And why do you want so many facts? Because when they start, you know, all the rationalization and excuses, rather than chasing all those rabbits, you come right back to, but here it is. Look right here. I see this. This is what's happening. Okay? Yes, ma'am. Is the other spouse a part of the intervention? Typically, no. Because, remember, from what we said yesterday, a lot of the self-delusion for married people is, it's all my spouse's fault. If you had talked to me in 1985, I would have convinced you that Alice was evil. Now, anybody who knew Alice would go, Alice? Alice is a saint. And, of course, in our story, if you understand it, Alice is the hero. She's the one who forgave me. She's the one who took me back. She is an extremely strong person. But I would have been so fluently telling you how evil she was. Now, if you had brought her into the intervention, I would have focused completely on her. You understand? Okay, so typically, no, you don't have the spouse. Now, by the way, I haven't mentioned this. You would assume it, but let me make sure you hear it. Pray, 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 pray. Pray for wisdom. Pray for courage. Pray for focus. Pray for evidence. God, we need evidence so we can convict this guy or this gal. Give us the evidence. Pray that God will give it to you. Pray, 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 pray. Because if God is in it, it works a whole lot better. Okay? All right, now, from the time you first start thinking about it until the time you do the intervention, it is recommended that you do not let more than 2 weeks pass. Why? Because it's not a pleasant thing to do, and you'll just keep, well, let's have another meeting. Let's talk about it some more. Let's have another meeting, like church. Say, we're going to get it done within 2 weeks. We're going to make it happen. Next slide, please. Decide the date, the time, the place. Decide who will get the person there and what method he or she will use. Know who will go first, who follows, et cetera, et cetera. Know who's going to give the responses. Set every detail beforehand. Now, surely you got a questionnaire like, well, how does that person get him or her there, right? We don't know how to do that part. No, I'm kidding. Okay.
Public place, private.
Public place? Preferably not. Attention, Kmart shoppers. I'm sorry?
Do you alert the offending party beforehand?
There's the question I expected. Okay.
Springing it on him.
Look at the next slide. I thought I had a slide that answered that question. Let's see what the next slide says and see. Oh, yeah, here it is. I do have that slide. The more experienced interveners say that an upfront explanation ensures the person will not be there. Right. But don't lie. You ever been called in a meeting that you were told was going to be about this, and that was just a lie because they were going to do that? How did you feel? Deceived? Like, where's the integrity in you? You don't lie. You do not tell them it's going to be about this, and then you do it about that. At the same time, you don't say, oh, by the way, we know you're committing adultery. Come on over, we're going to fix you. Because they're not going to come. What you do is you have one person in the team find a legitimate reason to request a meeting with the person. A legitimate reason, whatever it might be. Now, then you bring the person to where the other people are. They're already there. Okay? Then the person who invited him say, by the way, I really do want to talk to you about that, but not right now. We'll talk about that later. Right now, I sincerely, with all my heart, ask, would you just sit here for a few minutes for us to talk to you? And hopefully that person has enough relationship that even though they're caught off guard, that they will stay for a few minutes and then you get into the intervention. And I've done that. One of my buddies, good guy, he's a really good guy, but he got into porn. And one of his daughters found it on the computer. And I'm not going to go into all the details, but there were pictures of him. Now you can imagine what that does to a daughter, right? Okay. And so they call me because he's my buddy, and I love him to this day. He's a great man. I mean, good people can do bad things, but have you lived long enough to figure that out? And it doesn't mean they're evil. It just means they're screwed up right now, right? Can I say that, Lipscomb? All right, they're messed up right now. They're messed up right now. And so that was actually in a different state. And Alice and I went over there, and we were there, and they asked him to come for another reason, which they did deal with later, and he walked in, and we're sitting there, and he's like, well, hey, Joe, Alice, what are you doing here? And then he found out. And we did the intervention, but it was all worked out, and they had the facts. Now, we didn't pull out the pictures. You understand? But they were there. Like, we got this stuff here. All we're trying to do is convict this person, trying to get a moment of lucidity. That's all we're trying to accomplish, okay? So look at the next slide. Chair keeps everybody on track. I'm running out of time, so let's go a couple more here. How will you tell if the person experiences lucidity, which is what you're looking for, a moment when they see that what they're doing is wrong? That's what you're aiming for. The best indication is a heartfelt confession of wrongdoing. If you break through the person's self-delusion, and they finally come face-to-face with their harmful behavior, they'll be broken. The guy was just telling about my good buddy. He's really a good guy. He really is. He just broke right there in front of his children. They were all grown children. He broke in front of his children and us and wept and confessed what he did. Well, he didn't weep to begin with. To begin with, he was numb. He broke, and you could see it was intense, but he was numb. You can see that, right?
Yeah.
And he confessed everything. He confessed everything. Now, that's a moment of lucidity. Now, when that happened, you understand you have not fixed it, but you know, you have the opportunity to fix it, and so you always have worked out what it is you're going to ask them to do next. Always. For example, if it's a marriage problem, you might say, okay, there's one of Joe's workshops is 2 weeks from now. Will you commit right now to go to the workshop? It doesn't have to be our workshop, but you understand, whatever it is. Or if it's dealing with a porn addiction, it's like, we've already tentatively set you an appointment with this counselor that we know is good at that. Will you agree to go to that counselor next week? You always have a path. If you convict them and have no immediate path to direct them on, it's all going to fall apart on you. You've got to get a commitment right then for them to do something. I've actually seen them go right then and check into a hospital. Okay? I mean, like, get in the car. We'll drive you there now. They're waiting on us. Will you go? Okay. Next one, please. Do not let that moment, if they have lucidity, pass without taking full advantage of it to help the person. As soon as it occurs, the chair immediately offers the path to healing and gets the person's agreement to follow. In other words, if they break, you don't have to keep reading the other stuff. It's like, we now need to do what needs to be done. The very act of confession starts a healing. And look at this next slide. This is a quote from Bonhoeffer that I think is brilliant. When the confession of sin is made in the presence of a Christian brother, the last stronghold of self-justification is abandoned. The sinner surrenders. Confession and the presence of a brother is the profoundest kind of humiliation. It hurts. It cuts a man down. It's a dreadful blow to pride. But by confession, our brother breaks the circle of self-destruction. self-deception. A man who confesses his sins in the presence of a brother knows that he is no longer alone with himself. Now, you're thinking, so what if he doesn't? If he'll go to the path of healing and still hasn't made the confession, get him on the path. Maybe on the path they will come to that point of brokenness. The key is to get them to do what's right. I'm out of time, so I'll just tell you what number six is. Repeat. Be willing to do it again. By the way, in dealing with an alcoholic, the intervention that typically works is the sixth one. Now, you might be thinking, well, why would you keep going back? Because in AA, you've got a bunch of people that know what is going on. I'll give you a quick example. I don't go to AA much anymore, very little. But in AA, right here in Nashville, Tennessee, if somebody falls off the wagon and gets drunk and the sponsor finds out he's drunk, they get on the phone and start calling people and say, we're going to put him over here in this hotel room. We need pairs of two people to do 2 hours at a time. And so for 48 hours, we're going to have a pair change out every 2 hours for 48 hours. How long would you guess it takes the folks in AA here in Nashville to get all of those people lined up? 15 minutes. If you're doing that at church, how long would it take to get all those people lined up? Oh, and by the way, in Nashville, some of them are going to be stars, celebrities. They'll be right there in the hotel room with that drunk. Why? Because they know, but for the grace of God. Amen. Now, if people in AA can care enough to come back six times, why do we at church rarely do interventions at all? And if we do one and it doesn't work, we write them off. If you really care, you rescue. And you go back again and again and again as long as you possibly can, and you save a soul from death. And when he or she finally goes through the path of healing and straightens out, you have a warrior, a battle-hardened warrior. My time's up. Thank you very much.